Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Once again, we're joined by John Burns. John is president of John Burns Real Estate Consulting, which helps real estate industry executives by analyzing and summarizing the information they need to make decisions with more confidence. Mr. Burns is on retainer with a number of companies, both the housing industry and Wall Street, to monitor housing conditions and help them refine their strategies in an ever-changing environment. John, welcome back.
Thanks, Bruce.
For a builder to survive between 2007 and now, what has been the common theme for them that have survived?
Let me separate the publicly traded ones from the privately held ones.
Okay.
The publicly traded, well, let me talk about the privately first. The ones that were managing their balance sheet very carefully, just being careful to not get too overextended in debt, and maybe diversifying into some other businesses,
mm-hmm.
and selling some land at the top of the market have been the ones that have made it through.
Okay.
And some of the public builders, even after the market corrected, did some huge bulk land sales. That one was 34 cents on the dollar, another was 16 cents on the dollar. But it not only did it get them some cash in the bank, but they were able to recognize some tax losses and put get back millions of dollars that they had paid the IRS in prior years. And then the other thing that happened to the public builders was that the debt markets were wide open the last couple of years, and they've gone out to the debt markets and stuck out their debt maturities till 2016 or later. So they haven't had to pay any, you know, make principal payments. And those two things have really helped them significantly.
Okay, sort of from a lender's perspective, that's a straight note. So 2016, they have a lot of notes due.
Yes, they're bonds. They're not construction loans.
Okay, so they're bonds. When they come due, what happens at that point? They just get another bond, or they have to write a check?
Either or.
Okay.
But they're smarter than that too. They didn't have one big bond coming due in 2016. They've got little chunks due in various years. But at some point, yeah, you're going to have to either refinance that debt or pay it off.
Okay. Do you think anything rather spectacular will happen before 2016 for their world?
No. But the bondholders who buy that are managing your and my retirement funds.
Okay.
And you know, right now a 10-year treasury is what, 3%?
Yes.
So, you know, and a lot of this debt trades anywhere from 6 to 10 or 11%.
Okay.
There is an appetite for the high-yield portion of those funds where they'll take some risk. And, you know, if things get really bad, maybe they have to refinance from an 8% interest rate into a 10 or 11% one.
Okay.
But the guy who owns the 8 still gets paid off that way.
I see. Okay.
The real risk is if he can't refinance because someone thinks they're not going to make it.
Is there a big advantage being a public builder?
You know, the big advantage being a public builder is the access to the capital markets like that. If you were a private builder, you don't have that sort of access. And all this debt is non-recourse. I mean, the public builder CEOs sleep better than the private builder CEOs.
Okay.
They don't have recourse debt.
And obviously the debt's been available in sufficient quantities. Have there been land sales, lot sales that they've taken advantage of?
From purchasing land?
Yeah, in other words, have they loaded up or are they yet to do that?
The ones with the best balance sheets have bought quite a bit of land. So some of it with a really long-term perspective because they're not worried about any sort of cash crunch.
Okay.
The others, and all of the builders have been buying enough land to assure that they've got good revenue in 2012 and 2013. Much of the land they own is in tough areas where they can't make money, so they're trying to buy land in better locations, and then they'll come back to the tougher land someday in the future when it makes sense again.
Okay. And the financing is out there long enough to where that's okay? Are they talking about like a 10-year window, that type of thing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I think maybe 6 to 8 might be more common, but 6 to 8 years.
So what does a builder do in the meantime that's sensible?
That's a great question. In fact, someone just shared the statistic with me that the 12 largest publicly traded builders, they're sitting on $13 billion in cash. So what do you do with that cash? And they're redeploying it into their own business, but really, if you look at their incomes, they're breaking even. They're covering their overhead, I think, to stay alive for another day. Some of the more creative ones are now thinking about new businesses to get into. Toll Brothers is buying non-performing loans from the FDIC and starting a golf course management business. And Lennar is buying non-performing loans, and Beazer is now competing with you. They're buying REO in Phoenix and renting it out.
Yep. Well, there have been local builders that went and been involved in the trustee sale business, you know, to buy and resell and have houses to fix, that type of thing, which, right. You know, I just don't think they're used to the margins. And that's one thing that's certainly probably a misconception is how big of a margin there is in this business that we do. Right. It's shrunk.
And I know Beazer, for example, is hoping to make a 6 to 8% return on this. They're not looking for something bigger than that.
Yeah, now they're keeping it though, right? They're not reselling it. I think they're keeping them as rentals and kind of going long, with my understanding.
But I think the hope is to sell it at some point in the future.
Yeah, at some point in the future. Where,
right.
Yeah, if you're buying and reselling it, then the return's quite a bit better. But it's risky too. I mean, that's the thing. The market is very. It's not. California market, and well, I guess we can talk about that. It's really not, we're not dealing with the reality of what possibly could be here. So maybe I'd love to get your definition of what the word shadow inventory means to you.
Shadow inventory to me means it's a distressed sale that is not yet on the market for sale. So somebody's 90 days delinquent or more. The research we've done has shown very few of those delinquencies become current and the borrower gets saved. And if I've got my numbers right, there's about 4.5 million of those in the country today. Our best estimate is about 1.2 million of them are on the market. So there's, say, another 3.5 million or so shadow inventory, but more coming.
Yeah, the report that I saw, which is just about the same number as far as the total, had 91,000 resolutions in that particular month. So, you know, when we're in the buying and selling business, we're actually feeling pretty comfortable right now, because in Riverside, when you look at what's for sale, you have a few REOs, some of them in disrepair. You have a lot of short sales, but that's not really too exciting if you're an owner-occupant buyer, because it may take 4 months to get a yes or a no answer.
Right.
So you don't really have a lot of real inventory to sell against. But when you look at what's behind you, this churning shadow inventory, a lot of times is thought of lenders have already taken back the property and they're not presenting it on the market. I completely agree with your definition. It's the properties they refuse to foreclose on. And that was one of the things when we met with Fannie and Freddie, is that I think 30% of all the foreclosures are over 2 years behind. And I guess my point was, am I going to come here next year and say they're now 3 years behind? At some point, don't we have to cut to the chase?
I think you are. I'm trying to get some color on that, and it's all qualitative at this point. But I'll give your listeners a tip. There's a website called housingwire.com.
Absolutely.
Was founded by a guy from the mortgage servicing business, and he's very, very well connected there. And they're doing great stories every day. And they had a conference back in North Carolina a couple weeks ago that I attended, and all the top foreclosure attorneys were there and the CEOs of Fannie and Freddie. It was a big deal, and I became very convinced that virtually every judge in America hates the banks and doesn't trust them.
Mm-hmm.
And is really going to make it very difficult for them to move and act and foreclose the way they want to.
Well, you know, we had interviewed the president of MERS right after he testified in Congress. And simultaneously, almost the same week, I interviewed the president of the insurance industry, the title insurance business, because here was my concern. We're buying REOs, trying to resell them, and all of a sudden we get sued. And I'm not saying me, but this is happening in our industry. We're getting sued because somebody says, well, I was foreclosed on wrongfully.
Right.
Well, the idea of, okay, am I hanging out to dry here? You know, that's one of the reasons I interviewed the title guy, because I'm saying, okay, do we have title insurance in that case? And it's true if you buy an REO, but when we buy a trustee sales, that's not necessarily true.
No, and you're stepping into lender liability issues and a whole bunch of things.
Right. Right, so it's very different. And we do get title insurance literally the day we win the bid. And it has happened one time that we were sued for that same type of thing, that there was not a reason to foreclose. But recently, there has been courts that have upheld, and this is what you were saying, that when a commitment verbally has been made to a client that they're going to, in fact, pursue, the lender is agreeing to pursue a loan modification, and they foreclose on them anyway, then the client does have recourse and rights. And how would we know that? It makes it very difficult.
That's a great point.
Yeah, going.
Do you get a chance to interact with the borrower before you buy that note?
Well, we don't buy the note. We buy the property.
Okay.
And so it's rare. I mean, we do. And here's why. And this is another interesting twist about how the lenders conduct the sales. John, the only way there's a deal in Riverside is that if the lender lowers the bid.
Right.
So they're owed $500, and if they start opening bids, let's say at $200, then we have interest and we'll pursue checking out title and who's in the house and everything. Well, they let us know at 8 a.m. of a 10 a.m. sale. That's when the notice is.
I know. I've never understood that.
Yeah, that really is an amazing. I appreciate that because we have the infrastructure to be able to cope with that and get to a knowledgeable answer very quickly, and a lot of our competitors can. So we might end up with some deals that we wouldn't normally. But from the lender side, it's absolutely ridiculous because you end up with far less qualified people being able to bid up the price. So
fewer bidders.
Yeah. But to answer your question, it's rare that we're doing much interviewing of the person at the door, because a lot of times they're not answering it, or they're not there, or they tell you stories. So it's hard. You know, it's just one of those things. That's the business model. But I think what you're kind of saying, and this is not just in the courts, but also I think in politics, is that there's definitely a leaning away from housing. And boy, that's going to be so different than the 30 years we've just experienced for most of our careers.
Yep, you're absolutely right. And that's what we're planning for.
Well, that's interesting. Let's talk about building costs, because that's, as we see the prices, you know, go down in Riverside, at some point it dawned on me, okay, well, this is below replacement cost. That seems to be a safe bet that we're going to build another house in Riverside. So at some point, you'll probably make a profit. So what has happened to the cost of construction, say, from the peak, whenever that was, until about now?
You know, percentage-wise, I'd say maybe it's down 30 to 35%. But a portion of that is they're not putting as many bells and whistles in the house.
Okay, so they definitely have cut down the amenities.
Right.
Most of the savings come from labor?
Yes.
Okay.
Although materials as well. And that's pushing back on them a little bit with some of the commodity price increases lately. They are seeing some cost increases, but not on the labor side.
No. Are you in the camp? I just had a long interview with somebody that's really on the side of deflation. Do you ever get into that discussion? Whether we're going to have, let's say, in the next few years, a deflationary experience or inflation?
Yeah. I devour everything I can on it and try to come up with my own conclusions, but I do not feel like I'm qualified to pontificate on inflation.
Okay, and you know what? I feel very similar. I read everything I can. I think the practical side of me looks at the ability for labor to ask for more per hour, and I don't see that part of it.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And then I also remember learning in school that when they print a lot of money, that causes inflation. So I don't know what happens at the end of the day.
And then I look at Japan and say, well, wait a minute. They've printed a lot of money, and they don't have it. So, yeah. Well, I'm glad you're as confused as I am on that one. So, but it makes it a little bit more difficult as an investor to go forward and make the correct decision. So I guess you have to be conservative. And that's what you said. Most of the companies that have survived have done that.
Well, you know, there's an interesting twist to what we're talking about on costs here. Is I'm getting some early feedback from my clients that they think the cost of entitling lots is going to get much more expensive.
You got to be kidding.
Movement into environment. There's going to be environmental regulations. There are some stormwater mitigation efforts moving about that they say could just significantly increase the cost of new construction. The Army Corps of Engineers is making some changes. You know, I'll give you a great example up in Sacramento. After Hurricane Katrina, they changed the definition of what a 100-year floodplain was.
Oh.
And made an entire area of Sacramento called Natomas that was under development, stopped development because it no longer qualified, and they've got to go fix the levees before they can build anymore.
I've driven by that in a speaking assignment. Somebody drove me by that and told me that story.
Yeah. So yeah, I think this environmental movement that clearly is afoot in the country is going to make construction more expensive.
Well, on the same note, when you're fixing properties, I haven't seen legislation, but I've seen reports that sometimes lead to that. And I know that it's true that there are areas in California where now I have to have a permit for every rental that I have.
Well, and I think they're going to mandate more energy-efficient homes, too, which will be more expensive to build.
Well, not only mandate new ones, there's one city that mandates you're repairing the property to those standards.
Yeah. Can you believe that?
Yeah. So that's pretty scary. And I think that they have, and this is, I know that there's financing available for that type of work. And somehow it is equal to a tax lien, a superior lien to the first. That's an interesting twist.
Wow.
So I can buy a property, borrow money to do the green rehab. It becomes superior to my first trust deed in the case of a foreclosure or non-payment.
So your mortgage lender isn't going to like that at all.
No. And that's, you know, it's interesting. The unintended consequences of some of this stuff is you're going, come on, guys. You got to think this out a little better.
Yeah. Well, you know, an interesting and related matter is a lot of these CFD bonds, these Melrose bonds.
Yes.
A lot of my construction lending clients suddenly woke up and realized that they didn't make the first loan, they made the second. Because the Melrose lien was superior.
Oh.
And now they're the equity in the project rather than the debt.
Wow. That's not, maybe they can buy it at a discount since they need money so bad.
They're not equity holders.
Okay. The construction business in general, I mean, it's really obviously down. Commercial real estate's in the same boat. What percentage of employment or GDP does that represent that's sort of on the sidelines?
You know, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
I'll give you one bullish anecdote here. We never have bullish months. We always have bearish, it seems like. But I am getting wind that we are in the very, very early stages that we're going to see a lot of apartment construction. So, you know, that'll be good for the economy. Whether the apartment market will get overbuilt, only time will tell.
Okay. Well, that makes sense in one sense, because you're talking, you know, some of your statistics, as I looked at them, that you're thinking that housing is going to decline. Some of these 4.5 million people are going to not live there anymore.
Right.
But they're also going to create 4.5 million vacant residences. So I remember reading, you know, I read a lot of information on your website. There could be a case for them building apartments that are more attractive if they have the amenities people want. And I'm sure builders do a lot of asking about that.
Oh, no, they definitely do.
So they're not going to build an apartment complex that's bare bones, apparently. They're going to build one where you go, I'd rather be there than the house.
And they're not going to build it where in the Inland Empire. This is going to be tearing down retail and industrial in San Diego, Orange County, and L.A., and building in areas where people traditionally rent anyway. But the thought is everything we're talking about here, as we come out of this and do create millions of jobs, for all the reasons we've been talking about, people are going to be forced to rent.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really look at all the pro-government policy tendencies toward home ownership over the last 20 years reversing themselves, it's going to create an opportunity to build some apartment complexes, which really there have not been a lot built the last 20 years.
That's true.
And probably more importantly than anything else, and I'm starting to live by this moniker of demand and supply, it's not the fundamentals that matter, it's the demand and supply of capital. And I think the money is flowing in to build apartments. So that's what they're going to get built.
Okay. Does California's employment situation, has it ever been solved without construction being a major contributor? Like in the 90s and 80s? It seems like construction's a big piece of it.
Construction's a big piece of it. Yeah, no, I agree.
Okay.
I'm not sure it's ever been solved. Let me give you one interesting stat I just looked up in L.A. County. There are 350,000 fewer employees in L.A. today than in 1990.
350,000?
Than in 1990.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, it's like Japan. You know, it never really got solved. And you probably remember, it took to the year 2000 to get back to 1990 levels. Well, we've fallen since then. And these are documented employees. I'm sure there's more.
Yeah. Okay. Especially in Los Angeles, that's probably true. Do you know California's migration right now? Is it positive or negative?
I don't know those off the top of my head.
Okay.
But I believe it is positive.
Yeah, I still think it's slightly positive, which is really surprising to me. But I guess there's so many bad places in the country that we're not alone this time. In the 90s, we were sort of the worst case scenario, and now we're sort of one of the many.
Well, I think our migration is always, our domestic migration is always negative.
Yes, it is.
And then what backfills it, though, is the foreign immigration. And, you know, I think if you live south of here and you live in a lot of other places, regardless of how bad we think the economy is in California, it's a hell of a lot better economy and place to live than a lot of other places in the world.
One question I've got about all the stats that you have, affordability. Now, I look at it and think it's got to be the highest ever, which you agree on the first-time buyers, and yet it has a D-plus on your scale. So explain that one to me.
The pure affordability index, which is looking at housing costs in relation to income on our website, is actually an A-plus.
Okay.
It's when you look at some of the other factors that we group into affordability that are horrible. And so if you're a renter, today is the most affordable time to get in. If you're a homeowner, it's an F.
And that's because you lack equity to move around?
You lack equity. In fact, what's the most strongest F on here is the loan-to-value on existing homes. It's 85%.
Yeah, and that's so much higher than it was before.
Right.
Now,
that's terrible. And then also the income growth is something else we look at on this metric, and income growth is not very strong right now.
Does the debt-to-equity ratio, it doesn't include properties that are free and clear, just the ones that have debt?
Just yes. Yeah. So we took the 35% of all the owned homes don't have a mortgage. We took that out of the equation.
Okay. What's your feeling about commercial market?
Which one? Retail,
well,
office?
Apartment? Yeah, that's true. There's so many. California's office.
We're doing quite a bit of office work right now. As I mentioned, we've had to change our business. The commercial market is a lot like the residential market 4 or 5 years ago. They're staring at a lot of maturities coming due the
Absolutely.
Next couple of years.
Yeah.
And so the interesting conundrum there is, if interest rates stay low, I think you're going to see a lot of extend and pretend, because the loan-to-values won't come in, but the property can cash flow, given the interest rate being so low.
Mm-hmm.
But if interest rates go up, there's no hope of extending and pretending, and you'll see just a ton of distress. And include the properties that have a lot of vacancy are going to end up with distress. So we'll see quite a bit of distress in the office market.
John, we've run out of time. Thanks so much for joining us. It's been John Burns, Real Estate Consulting. Please check out his website. And John, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Bruce.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.